So, Joe, you weren't around in 37. You know these from recordings. But we're about to go to a recording based on an experience you had here in New York City when you were a young man.
Right. I was subjected to Mravinsky shock. We heard about George Sell experiencing Toscanini shock in 1930. I think if the Boston Symphony had gone to Berlin in 1930, there would have been Koussevitzky shock. And most certainly, if Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra had gone to Berlin in 1930, there would have been a seismic Stokowski shock that would not necessarily have been a pleasant shock, but it would have been a shock. The most shocking experience I ever had listening to an orchestra was when I stumbled upon the Leningrad Philharmonic at the age of 15, the one and only time they came to America with Mravinsky, which was in 1963, and I heard them perform Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. It was a mind-blowing experience for me, and it belongs in the story we're telling because Mravinsky was behind the Iron Curtain and conditions were different. He conducted this orchestra, I looked it up, from 1938 to 1988, folks. That's
wow.
50 years. And during those 50 years, I believe it is true that he almost never conducted anywhere else, or rather any other orchestra. So this was a bonding experience that occurred behind closed doors in a musical culture that was somewhat self-contained and was fortified by a couple of living composers named Shostakovich and Prokofiev. Mm. And Mravinsky was the guy who often was the conductor of first performances of the Shostakovich symphonies. So it's not just about a disembodied orchestra. It's about an orchestra that's part of a community of culture. So why don't we listen to this first and then talk about it? And I can recall for you, once my ear is refreshed, why I was in shock after hearing the Leningrad Philharmonic in 1963 play Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. This is the recording they made in 1960. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hear movement number 3. Thank you. I don't know if that's a sufficient dose for you to glean. I'd never heard an orchestra, first of all, with such a wide dynamic range, especially in the strings. The whole instrument vibrated. I heard sounds I'd never heard before. The trumpets were a little bit like kazoos. A lot of vibrato, kind of nasal intonations in the winds. But the violins were the most shocking feature of this orchestra. Everything had been phrased and shaded to a fare-thee-well. Hardly a note passed without some specific articulation or shading. The sound throbbed. I'd never heard such a colorful sound from an orchestra before, and I was in shock when it was over.
What impressed me most, I guess, upon hearing it just for the first time, is the grace of the performance. It's a little waltz tune. At either end of the Fifth Symphony, you get big dramatic stuff. This is a rather gentle piece. It could almost fit into the music that he would later compose for Nutcracker. It could almost be a dance scene.
It's a waltz. Yeah, but there's an enormous urgency to the waltz in this performance. It's rather brisk, wouldn't you say?
I found the tempo perfect.
I mean, is it normally this fast?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a slow one. You don't beat it in three, of course. But yeah, no, for me, it was very natural.
Could we hear the first movement, just some of it, of this Fifth Symphony? So that's the violin sound I've never heard since. What do you think?
That's wonderful. Yeah. The strings are really the glory of this band. Oh, I have to say, I'm liking the Winds very, very much, too. They have a personality, and yet they make a wonderful blend.
I now have this Tchaikovsky sound in my ear. I also heard it when the Bolshoi Opera came to New York in the 1970s and did Eugene Onegin. This sound with so much vibrato in the horns and the nasal trumpets. It just sits well for me, for Tchaikovsky. It seems to me to suit the tenor and sonority of this music. But we'll never hear it again, and we will not hear it from the St. Petersburg Philharmonic, which is to say today's Leningrad Philharmonic. This is gone for good. It's gone forever.
Huh. Are the orchestras, you happen to know, in Russia now, more diverse in national makeup than they were in the past?
Oh, of course.
So you got, like, Asians from across their empire and Germans in it and Scandinavians, all sorts?
Well, just judging from the evidence of my eyes when I see the Mariinsky Theater Orchestra, it looks ethnically diverse to me.
May well be. Yeah. So maybe we're getting all whipped into this homogenous thing, which is one of the kind of complaints that you have.
So we're going to close with Post-Classical Ensemble, which is my orchestra, which is to say the orchestra I co-founded in D.C. in 2003 with a wonderful Spanish conductor, Ángel Gil Ordóñez, based on the premise that what we've been listening to is over and gone. And if we're to create a sense of occasion, we need to do something different. I often talk about sense of occasion. I think that's a basic criterion for a musical event. Does it generate a sense of occasion? And if you go back to Henry Higginson and the Boston Symphony, you'll discover that the sense of occasion was automatic. One, you could not hear an orchestra in your living room. And two, living composers mattered greatly to that audience. So when Mr. Nikisch or Mr. Mook stepped on the podium at Symphony Hall, that was a singular experience, not something that was something you could daily create by pushing a button on a console. The implications of this, to me, are profound, and I've long believed that orchestras need to fundamentally rethink the way they present music in public performance. And that is the premise upon which Post-Classical Ensemble is based. My first experience with this premise was when I was the executive director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic at BAM in the 1990s, and I sufficiently convinced myself that all programming should be thematic, as much as possible cross-disciplinary, and linked to other institutions. So this season, for instance, we began with a program in D.C. called Mozart, Amadeus, and the Grand Partita. This was our way of presenting the most famous of all wind serenades by Mozart. And what I wanted to do was show what was new about it. So we had the participation of the Washington Ballet Studio Company and a wonderful actor, Philip Hosford, who played Salieri. I created a script based in part on Peter Schaffer's Amadeus, and we were able to show the difference between wind music before the Grand Partita, which was music that you could use for gossiping and dancing and flirting, and the Grand Partita, which is music for listening. So this was a 90-minute production. In March, we're doing a Shostakovich-Weinberg concert with Alexander Taradze, where we'll have another actor, Edward Giro, as Shostakovich, and I've created a script, not for the first time, out of Testimony, the memoirs of Shostakovich by Solomon Volkov. And Giro will be seen both on film, where he's reading prepared statements that Shostakovich gave in the 30s and 40s about the Fifth and Seventh Symphonies, and live, where later in life he is, contradicting what he had to say in the 30s and 40s. And this is a 25-minute dramatic interlude midway through the concert. What we're going to close with is another such event. When we did Dvorak in America, we created a new piece called the Hiawatha Melodrama. This is co-composed by myself and the Dvorak specialist Michael Beckerman. Some of the orchestration was done by Angel, and it mates the Song of Hiawatha, by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow with the New World Symphony and other works from Dvorak's American period. Like so much of what we do, it's informed by scholarship. And scholarship tells us, in particular Michael Beckerman, that the middle movements of the New World Symphony are, as Dvorak said, saturated with the Song of Hiawatha. So
that was an opera which he never got around to composing, right?
An opera or cantata, so we've created it for him. If you want to know what that would have sounded like, listen to the Hiawatha melodrama. This is a Naxos CD. Kevin Days is the soloist. This was named one of the best CDs of the year by Minnesota Public Radio. It's like a little kit. It's other music as well, pertinent to the story of Dvorak in America. Anyway, for those of you who know the scherzo of the New World Symphony, when Dvorak composed that, he had in his mind the whirling, spinning dance of Paupakiwis at Hiawatha's wedding. And what we're going to hear now is the C-sharp minor episode from the Largo, where Dvorak was thinking of the death of Minnehaha in winter. And these little tremolos in the first violins, I'm sure, were inspired in Dvorak's sonic imagination by the freezing cold and the shivering Indians who are described in Longfellow's poem. We'll hear just a part of this. So this is my version of the Largo reassembling the component parts that were in the composer's imagination.
Hardly from his buried wigwam could the hunter force a passage. Vainly walked he through the forest, saw no track of deer or rabbit, fell and could not rise from weakness. Wasting of the famine, oh, the blasting of the fever, oh, the wailing of the children, oh, the anguish of the women. All the earth was sick and famished. Hungry was the air around them, hungry was the sky above them, and the hungry stars in heaven, like the eyes of wolves, glared at them. Far away, amid the forest, rose the desolate Hiawatha. Heard that sudden cry of anguish, heard the voice of Minnehaha. Hiawatha! Hiawatha! Rushed into the wigwam, saw his lovely Minnehaha lying dead and cold before him. With both hands his face he covered, speechless, motionless, unconscious of the daylight or the dark.
Lovely. Ends in the minor that way.
Well, that's the cadence that I wrote. You're listening to part of Minnehaha's Death from the Hiawatha melodrama co-composed by Dvorak, myself and Mike Beckerman, and based on evidence mainly culled by Mr. Beckerman that correlates passages from the New World Symphony with verses from the Song of Hiawatha, an undoubted inspiration, the composer told us so.
I remember he read the Song of Hiawatha in Czech.
He did.
Before he came to the U.S.
He did.
And he had this idea all of his life. So you actually helped him finish the opera that he didn't get around to writing.
I do truly believe, Bill, that if you listen to this 35-minute melodrama, you will glean what a Hiawatha cantata or opera by Dvorak might have sounded like. And it would have been a formidable achievement.
Who was our speaker just now?
That was the bass baritone Kevin Days, who's also heard on this CD singing Going Home. I'd like to just mention the concert, because that's what we're talking about, refreshing the concert experience. This is a concert, the first half of which was the String Serenade and the American Suite, which instantly juxtaposes his Czech style with his American style. And I do believe the American Suite, though less known, is a stronger piece than the String Serenade. Intermission, then we did the world premiere of the Hiawatha melodrama, and the program ended with Going Home, which is the spiritual, the ersatz spiritual created out of the Largo of the New World Symphony. We had super titles and an image of Dvorak, which faded in during the performance of Going Home, so that we ended the concert with the image of the composer on the screen over the stage. Did I mention this was post-classical ensemble conducted by Angel Gil Ordóñez?
Lovely. What photo did you use?
Oh, it's one of the iconic portraits of...
Is he wearing a hat?
No, he was not wearing a hat.
Okay. Dvorak's a favorite composer, and there are some photos I cherish. There's one where he went on the road with his buddies from the Dumpke Trio, including the great cellist from whom he wrote the cello concerto. And the three of them wearing these derby hats and smoking big, stinky cigars. It's just the cutest thing to see.
So let me press you further. This is the first time you've been exposed to this correlation between Minnehaha's death in winter mm-hmm. and the C-sharp minor episode from the Largo. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
I thought it worked remarkably well. And I'll say my heart was in my mouth a little bit, because it's dangerous to take something so beautiful and so well-known as the Largo, the New World Symphony. But you excerpted the center of it. Largo is in D-flat major. This is in C-sharp minor. It's like the blues version of the Largo. And I thought it worked remarkably well.
One thing you learn from this study of the New World Symphony in relationship to Dvorak's poem is something profound about the work methods of the composer. Like many composers, he, at least in this instance, did not begin with a blank slate. He had a story, characters, images in mind. The reason there's a triangle in the scherzo is what, Bill?
I have no idea.
The Indians have bells on their moccasins.
Uh-huh.
There's an Indian dance in the American suite, and it also has a triangle. So my inference, I'm sure, is correct.
Couldn't be a third movement of Brahms' Fourth Symphony,
that could it? Don't be a wise guy on me. That doesn't mean that we're supposed to hear the scherzo as an Indian dance. But there would be no triangle in that scherzo if Dvorak himself had not heard it as an Indian dance.
Interesting.
And similarly, there are details in the music we just heard. And by that I mean the tremolo in the first violin, which is an interrupted tremolo, a very unusual tremolo. I feel that we can infer that Dvorak, since he was inspired by a very frigid winter landscape, thought of adding that detail to his orchestration.
Well, Joe, it's been a real pleasure spending this afternoon with you listening to these wonderful old recordings. You bring such insight along with all of your scary, vast knowledge. And it's been a real pleasure to be on the other side of the microphone from you.
So you'll have to tell me how you ultimately process the shock of hearing Metropolis's recording.
I'm still not over that.
It's still freaking me out.
It's like, whack, it's too much. Wow, no, it's cool. I get it. No, oh, it's too much again. I don't know. I'd have to hear it again. It's just the first take.
But that's great. I mean, imagine if we could more frequently have such a confounding experience listening to music and performance.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Bill.
You've been listening to an informal discussion between Bill McLaughlin, host of Exploring Music, and Joseph Horowitz, noted music historian, author, and executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Post-Classical Ensemble. You can check out his writing at his website, josephhorowitz.com, including his recent blog post to Arts Journal about music in our current and our current national mood. Let us know what you thought about tonight's program by emailing your comments to info@wwfm.org. We want to thank our recording engineer for this broadcast, Bill Ziegman. This program acted as a preamble to our new, unique, and exciting bi-monthly series beginning in April, a rethinking of the concert experience featuring the Post-Classical Ensemble recorded on disc and live in concert. Some upcoming episodes of the new series, to whet your appetite, will be celebrating the Lou Harrison centenary in April, the most underrated 20th century American composer, a Bernard Herrmann tribute in June. As we go forward, other programs in the series will include Dvorak and Hiawatha, Schubert Uncorked, Copland and Film, Sylvester Revueltas, Better Than Copland, The Shostakovich-Weinberg Connection, Harry Berley, a forgotten hero of American music, and Stravinsky and Shostakovich Reconceived. That'll be Post-Classical coming your way on a bi-monthly basis beginning in April. I'm David Ozenberg, and for the remainder of this program, let's hear two more movements from the Hiawatha melodrama. We will hear Hiawatha's Wooing and Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, the text of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, here set by one of our guests, Joseph Horowitz, and the Dvorak scholar Michael Beckerman. The music comes from Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, The New World, as arranged by Angel Gil Ordonez, who leads the Post-Classical Ensemble, our narrator, the bass baritone Kevin Dace. I'm David Ozenberg. This preamble program to our new bi-monthly series Post-Classical, which begins in April, is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.
As unto the bow the cord is,
So unto the man is woman. Though she bans him, she obeys him. Though she draws him, yet she follows. Thus the youthful Hiawatha said within himself and pondered. Much perplexed by various feelings. Listless, longing, hoping, feeling, dreaming still of Minnehaha, of the lovely laughing water. There the ancient arrow maker made his arrowheads of sandstone. With him dwelt his dark-eyed daughter, wayward as a Minnehaha, with her moods of shade and sunshine. Eyes that smiled and frowned alternate, tresses flowing like the water, and as musical a laughter. And he named her from the river, from the waterfall, he named her Minnehaha, Laughing Water. Was it then for heads of arrows that my Hiawatha halted in the land of the Dakotas? Was it not to see the maiden, see the face of laughing water peeping from behind the curtain, hear the rustling of her garments from behind the waving curtain? As one sees the Minnehaha gleaming, glancing through the branches, as one hears the laughing water from behind its screen of branches. Thus departed Hiawatha to the land of handsome women. Through uninterrupted silence with his moccasins of magic. And he journeyed without resting till he heard the Minnehaha. Straight, the ancient arrow maker looked up gravely from his labor, bade him enter at the doorway, saying as he rose to meet him, Hiawatha, you are welcome. And the lovely laughing water seemed more lovely as she stood there. Neither willing nor reluctant, as she went to Hiawatha, softly took the seat beside him, while she said, and blushed to say it, I will follow you, my husband. Pleasant was the journey homeward, through interminable forests, over meadow, over mountain, over river, hill, and hollow. Short it seemed to Hiawatha, though they journeyed very slowly. Though his pace was checked and slackened to the steps of laughing water. From the sky benignant, looked upon them through the branches, saying, Oh, my children, love is sunshine, life is checkered, shade and sunshine. Rule by love, O Hiawatha. Thus it was they journeyed homeward. Thus it was that Hiawatha brought the sunshine of his people, Minnehaha, laughing water, handsomest of all the women in the land of the Dakotas. In the land of handsome women. You shall hear how Paupokiwis danced at Hiawatha's wedding. First he danced a solemn measure, treading softly like a panther. Then more swiftly and still swifter, whirling, spinning round in circles, leaping o'er the guests assemble, heading round and round the wigwam, till the leaves went whirling with him like great snow drifts o'er the landscape. Thank you. gentle Chibiabos sang in accents sweet and tender. On a way, awake, beloved. Thou the wild flower of the forest, thou the wild bird of the prairie, thou with eyes so soft and fawn-like, if you only look'st at me, I am happy. I am happy as the lilies of the prairie when they feel the dew upon them. On away, awake, beloved. And among the guests assembled at my Hiawatha's wedding sat the marvelous storyteller. And they said, O good Iagoo, tell us now a tale of wonder. And Iagoo answered straightway, You shall hear the strange adventures of Osio, the magician. Once in days no more remembered in the Northland lived a hunter, with 10 young and comely daughters. All these women married warriors. Only Oweenie, the youngest, laughed and flouted all her lovers, and then married old Osio. Old Osio, poor and ugly. But Osio was transfigured, was restored to youth and beauty, but alas for good Osio, and for Oweenie the faithful, changed into a weak old woman. Then a voice was heard, a whisper coming from the starry distance. O Osio, broken are the spells that bound you. Then the lodge began to tremble, and they felt it rising, rising slowly through the air ascending, from the darkness of the treetop forth into the dewy starlight. And behold, the wooden dishes all were changed to shells of scarlet. And behold, the earthen kettles all were changed to bowls of silver. All the sisters and their husbands changed to birds of various plumage. Some were jays, some were magpies, others thrushes, others blackbirds. And they hopped and sang and twittered, pecked and fluttered all their feathers, and their tails like fans unfolded. Then returned the youth and beauty of Oweenie the youngest. And her staff became a feather, yes, a shining silver feather. Such was Hiawatha's wedding, such the dance of Paupukiwis, such the story of Iagoo, such the songs of Chibiabos. Thus the wedding banquet ended, and the wedding guests departed.